Wow. We had heard rumors ahead of this State of the Union address from President Joe Biden that this was a lengthy speech. We were settling in. This speech was long in word count, but it was delivered with a lot of energy and a lot of pace and a combativeness and sort of liveliness that I'm not sure that I've ever seen in this particular type of presidential address. We had a number of instances in which it appeared to be, our sense was that there were members of Congress on the Republican side who were shouting at him, heckling, at least responding to him, rather than him shutting that down or ignoring that or having it be sort of a crisis moment. He instead took those opportunities to have the argument, to challenge them back, to bring the pace even further to the fore. I think probably the most remarkable one of those moments, maybe what the speech will be remembered for, was about halfway through, in discussing first the debt and the deficit, then the need to raise the debt ceiling, and then ultimately whether or not Social Security and Medicare will be threatened by the Republican Congress. He appeared to turn the heckling back on the Republicans and sort of trick them into agreeing with him publicly that they wouldn't do that. Chris Hayes, you were remarking on that as being a moment that reminded you a little bit of not so much of a previous State of the Union, but of that moment during the Obama presidency when he went into the Republican caucus meeting and had a back and forth with them.
This was at the peak of the ACA debate. You don't want to debate someone who's on stage. Generally, you want to stay out of debates with the person that has the bully pulpit
and has the only microphone in the room.
And the only microphone. And I thought that was a truly a remarkable moment for a bunch of reasons. One, it was kind of him rhetorically at his best. Two, I think you got a sense of what he would be like in the room in negotiations on the budget. Like, he was kind of cutting but jocular at the same time and then sort of joking about us all getting consensus. It also showed, and this was, I think, true of the first two-thirds of the speech, the agenda on domestic policy that he has proposed and passed and is proposing now is broadly popular stuff. And he really just led with that and stayed with that and wanted to keep putting in their face. And when he said, some of you have proposed sunsetting Medicare and Social Security, they got angry because the truth of the matter is some of them have proposed that, including Rick Scott, who ran the Democratic Senate campaign, the Republican Senate campaign, much to the chagrin of Mitch McConnell, as well as Ron Johnson. So he's squarely on the facts there. And I just think you saw in that moment, like, he understands that he has 60-40 on his side on a bunch of issues, particularly on this brass tax kitchen table economic stuff that he dominated the speech with, and is more than happy to put Republicans on the defensive.
And it drove them crazy in a way that he got to get them upset. In the moment.
Stand up and show them we will not cut Social Security. And then they start howling. He goes, well, stand up then.
Yes.
So stand up. And it's literally brilliant speechcraft, honestly, because it uses Joe Biden's sort of natural pugnacious, sort of lighthearted pugnaciousness to his advantage and to their extreme disadvantage. The things they're howling at are not arguable. Rick Scott not only proposed sunsetting Social Security, he wrote it down and put it forward as their plan for America to Mitch McConnell's outrage. He was like, don't write that down and publish it. But he was like, no, I'm going to go on Fox News and defend it. So he's right on the facts. He literally said, okay, fine, offer your plan. He starts riffing with them. And as you said, Chris, they're literally arguing with the only guy with a microphone, and he held that stage. This was Biden, I think, at his best in terms of his public performance. He was a little rowdy. Mm-hmm. Right? He was a little fun. He did his Bidening with the people that he was showing empathy toward, including Tyree Nichols' parents. But he also, I feel like he baited them throughout. The parts where Kevin McCarthy couldn't stand showed his weakness in the caucus, that he couldn't stand up for democracy, for Ukraine, things that would have in the past been solid Republican issues. He couldn't stand up.
remarkable.
The part of the speech that got the, I think the other thing that is now forever changed is because MAGA has taken over the chamber, we now are going to see things like this, right? And I think rattle a different politician. Not only was Joe Biden not rattled, it unleashed the ability to ad lib because that's what the moment called for, not because he needed to find his pace or sort of make a point in his sort of voice and his colloquialisms. But when they started, you also know now where all the trigger points are for this GOP. So when they start getting out of their seat and angsting and shouting, some of my Republican friends want to take the economy hostage unless I agree to their economic plans. All of you at home should know what they are. That's when you hear the first shout. Then he says, instead of making the wealthy pay their fair share, some Republicans want Medicare and Social Security to sunset every 5 years. More howling. He looks at them and he says, not all of you. They don't stop. It culminates when he goes, well, apparently it's not going to be a problem. He has box them in a half a page of a 26-page speech. It's almost like mission accomplished on page 12.
Yeah. The way that they started getting rowdy there was the immediate paragraph before that when he said, in the last 2 years, my administration has cut the deficit by more than $1.7 trillion. Under the previous administration, America's deficit went up 4 years in a row. You start getting grumbling from the Republicans. Because of those record deficits, no president added more to the debt in any 4 years than my predecessor. More and more angry. At which point he starts going, look it up, look it up, look it up. And they're getting madder and madder and madder. And it culminates on that same page of the script in the next paragraph, the next point that he makes in him getting them against their will to stand up and cheer for Joe Biden's assertion that nobody's going to cut Social Security or Medicare.
Ever.
Ever. And they're never going to do it. It starts off with them saying, I'll veto it. And they're saying, like, you won't have to. We won't do that. And he's like, okay.
Good. Let's all stand
we'll
up.
All have a unifying moment. I mean, I've never seen anything like that in a State of the Union or in any presidential
address. Was the single most confrontational State of the Union address that we have ever seen.
Absolutely.
And anyone who picked Joe Biden for that is quite a good guesser. I mean, I never would have predicted that this guy who goes in there deliberately determined to do the opposite.
Yes.
Ends up delivering the most confrontational State of the Union address ever. And the confrontation was directly and mostly one-on-one with the person who's in a very strong competition for stupidest person in the room, and that's Marjorie Taylor Greene. And the camera found her jumping up individually, yelling at him when he was reciting Rick Scott's Medicare Social Security proposal, which is that it expires every 5 years, then we think about it again. She's jumping up yelling liar at him when he says that, and he engages with her and with that group over there and does something we've never seen before. He negotiates the budget during the State of the Union on live TV, and he wins and gets there, in effect, unanimous consent. I mean, this was the worst possible night for Kevin McCarthy.
Yes,
the negotiation ended in that room with Marjorie Taylor Greene yelling at a president who took her on, handled it right in front of McCarthy. And McCarthy, by the way, there's an isolated camera of McCarthy that's going to show him saying no, no, no every single time they did that.
And trying to shush his members. He's saying shush,
trying to shush every one of them every time. This is over for McCarthy. The year is over. He lost it right there in that moment.
And can we just, maybe I shouldn't note, it's a bit petty, but she gets up and starts yelling in like the strangest fur coat. I mean, people were comparing it to like the wife of a deposed Russian oligarch or something.
Wow.
And she gets up and just starts pointing and making a spectacle. It's the opposite of what Kevin McCarthy needed tonight.
Maybe
he needed his members to have some dignity.
Cold. I don't know. Biden understands the truth, which is McCarthy has no power in this caucus. He's along for the ride. And as much as he is going to say, not all of you, the reality is the madmen are running the asylum. At the very end of the speech, Biden is making sort of, you know, in some ways, platitudes towards, you know, what democracy means. And there's no place for political violence in America. In America, we must protect the right to vote, not suppress that fundamental right. We honor the results of our elections, not subvert the will of the people. There is a season in which this is
stating the obvious.
Yep.
And yet half of this room did not get up.
Yeah.
McCarthy, the best Kevin McCarthy could do was applaud from his seat because, as you were saying, we were talking about it during, as it was happening, his Republican Party does not want to recognize how democracy works, does not want to take subverting the will of the people off the table. That's the reality. And that's why, in the most high-stakes negotiation of the moment, Joe Biden is talking to Marjorie Taylor Greene.
I will say, in terms of logistically what's happening here, we're watching the president in the room continuing to have some quite detailed conversations with lots of people who are there to see the speech. We expect that the Republican response to the president's State of the Union will happen 5 minutes after President Biden leaves the chamber. But any bets on how long it's going to take him to leave the chamber? He is more, he's taking an even sweeter time of it than he did on the way in. You see Kevin McCarthy back there at the dais hanging out. Still, President Biden.
Wondering what happened.
President, I mean, he'll have to gavel out the session, presumably, at the end of it. I will say that the speech, structurally, and Lawrence, I take your point absolutely on how confrontational this was, but he starts the speech with a congratulations to this Congress and to Kevin McCarthy, the new Speaker of the House, and he, you know, also congratulates Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer, but goes out of his way to do Kevin McCarthy first, to congratulate the Senator McConnell on his longevity as the Senate leader. He ends with a shout out for George W. Bush's global AIDS program. That's why the lead singer from U2, Bono, was there to celebrate the success of PEPFAR, which is a very controversial Republican administration's greatest lasting legacy. And he throughout is willing to not only talk about the ideal of bipartisanship, but praise every bipartisan aspect of everything that he has been able to do as president. And while giving the Republicans that much love, he also absolutely pins them down like a butterfly under glass on the substantive thing he needs them to agree to so they won't crash the economy by holding that particular hostage.
And there's a standard play for this, that when the president is up there saying the single thing that embarrasses your party the most, which is usually something that's been said by one or two or five members of your party, you just sit there silently. It's going to go by really fast.
Yes.
You just sit there silently, okay? This party, with Marjorie Taylor Greene leading them, decides we want to really emphasize what he just said about one of our ideas. And we want to emphasize it by denying it. Every media outlet except the propagandists will tomorrow be saying, yes, this is a Republican idea. Biden was right. And then Biden engages in it brilliantly in that situation. And that's where experience matters. That
Absolutely.
Took all the experience in the world. And his comfort in that room, and the fact that he's not out of that room because he loves that room so much, and is the slowest exit of any president ever because he loves being there. And that grit that he had, that poise and control that he had in that moment, just changed what's going to happen this year.
It also built. I mean, so that's the first time he engages him, but he's in a fentanyl section that culminates in the border. What we're going to stop and they didn't stop after that engagement. And so he's ready for it, and he's turning around and engaging her while Kevin McCarthy is craning his neck to look at God knows what.
Well, McCarthy's kind of the referee, right? He's the guy here who's telling you, he's showing you on his face, this is how harmful this is for us.
Right.
This is what she's doing out there to this president. This is how harmful it is.
Remember the argument that went into this is there's a lot of anxiety in the Democratic sort of political world about Biden's age. He shattered that tonight. He's obviously his experience. It's similar to what Nancy Pelosi is able to do. There's certain things that an experienced politician can do, to your point, Lawrence, that an inexperienced politician, even a Kevin McCarthy who's been around a long time, but is obviously not as ready for prime time as Joe Biden. Joe Biden, who has done these negotiations at a high level as a United States senator and was, you know, a committee chairman and just knows everyone, half those people in the room, he knew how to cleave Mitch McConnell apart from Marjorie Taylor Greene and cleave in the audience He kept saying, I get it. He kept talking to the audience, bringing the audience in. What he's essentially saying, if you are a Republican who thinks more like a Mitt Romney or a Mitch McConnell, you can leave those cuckoos behind. Let them go. The lady in the fur is not your people. I'm your people. I'm your people if you're at all moderate, if you're at all normal, and you have a normal political will. He went at things like fees for airlines, fees for hotels. He's like, we're going to stop all that. The American people, he said, are tired of getting suckered. That sounds like what Trump said when he ran. Yeah. He's saying, we're not going to let them sucker you anymore. Everyone who has a normal desire to see politics protect you from corporations who steal from you, from people who are chucking drug therapies you can't afford for your kid, you're with us. Marjorie and them who are screaming, they're over there. He set them aside and set them apart. I thought it was brilliant.
You also saw it in just the sheer structure of the speech. Two-thirds of the speech was on this stuff. It was on brass tacks, their agenda, the bipartisan bill, the CHIPS Act, job creation, junk fees, all this sort of stuff.
$130,000 right? jobs for which you do not need a four-year college degree. Yep.
All the other stuff, and I will say, this is something that I was shocked by, honestly. Abortion got three lines. Mm-hmm. Roe v. Wade got overturned in the last year. Now, if you're Joe Biden, you think, well, there's not a lot we're going to do. And I will say that I'm going to veto a national abortion ban. But it was, you know, it's a zero sum game, right? You're making choices about what you emphasize and what you don't. And what you saw was that was the lead of the speech. Was that the kind of middle class political economy, economic agenda stuff? Everything else, which is in the back half of the speech, after the pivot, including Ukraine, including LGBTQ rights, including abortion, including immigration, that just got very, very little. And that's a choice they're making about where they're strongest with this audience and with this Congress.
Well, he did spend a lot of time, though, I think, with Tyree Nichols' family.
Yes.
Which I thought was another really strong point in the speech.
And it was subtle.
And it was subtle. And his interaction
and
with
that got
them
a lot more time than
got a
those
lot
other
more
things,
time,
yes.
Right? And he sort of spent time with it. And I thought what he said was really smart. If you are someone who is frustrated that there hasn't been more action on police reform, he didn't get up there and say the normal Democratic talking points. We need to fund the police more, give them more money. He did say the training line, which is a bit tired, and it is sort of what is standard in the discussion of it. But he said, we need to have police earn the trust of the community. He recounted the talk that black folk, all of us, gave our kids, and those of us who were terrified that our
with
kids
emotion.
Get pulled over.
He actually
with
choked
emotion.
Up a little bit when he was talking.
Absolutely, and he understood it, and he sort of, the empathy was there for the victims of police violence, and he didn't say, we're going to fund the police more. He said, we're going to fund communities. We're going to fund community programs. We're going to make sure there's less crime in these neighborhoods. He talked about funding the people. Mm-hmm. And I think that will resonate with folks who've been very skeptical that Joe Biden, the working class cop friend Democrat, will actually have passion for police reform.
It was also interesting, too. I will say that while I love the State of the Union as much as the next dork, I have found over the years that the use of people, regular people, as props to make points in the speech, I find to be cynical, and it bothers me. Mm-hmm. When he got to this part of the speech with Tyree Nichols' mother and father, and he singled them out and he just said, welcome. And there was this quiet moment where they were acknowledged in the room. But then he stayed with that story of their son and they stayed with the topic and he went back to them again and again. And he kept looking back at them and he stayed with that story. And he talked about, he quoted her. He said that we should respond to her, to his mother. It was the opposite of the person being there as a problem.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
And that actually, I think, was maybe a structurally unique in terms of the way presidents do it. I found it very moving.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But to have somebody there, there's going to be a bunch of people, you tag them in order to make a point. I got it. Yeah. But you can, it's okay to do that with Bono. It's not okay to do that with a mother who has just lost her son.
And you know that Biden taught, I mean, the difference between Biden and a lot of these, you know that he spent an hour and a half with that woman. You can feel that he has spent actual time with the people he invited, that he made a personal connection, because literally that is what Bidening is, right? Yeah.
And there's also this, I mean, there's this thing that he's trying to do, and you see it in the agenda, and Joy, you mentioned this before, to the extent there was something in the Trump critique, right, of the post-NAFTA neoliberal order, right? The hollowed out towns, the fact that manufacturing went away, the fact that you used to be able to get a job without a college degree. And there was something to that part of the critique. The whole thing is to make real policies that actually address that and to lead with the messaging on it. So like, if you're an iron worker, you're going to build a bridge. We're going to have these intel jobs. They're not going to require a college degree. Like, the whole way of trying to make the core of the Trump critique about the kind of passed over parts of America in the post-1990s economy, which is true. Like, that's a true thing about the country. It's so striking how on message they are on that and how focused they are on that median voter, that voter they imagine.
But because I think he thinks that's the central problem with American democracy.
Yes.
That's the fraying at the edges. To restore the soul of the nation, you've got to bring back
those
parts
folks,
of the Republican Party that have defected to MAGA land.
No, President Biden just left the room. And I can tell you, last year, after the State of the Union, it took him 17 minutes to get out of the room after he concluded his speech, which was the all-time record. Mm-hmm. Tonight he beat it. Yeah. Tonight he took him even longer.
How long?
It was longer than 17. I stopped counting.
I think it was 20 or 22 minutes.
So that was the longest time. Yeah. And thus starts the clock ticking on just 5 minutes until we expect the Republican response from newly minted Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Before we get to that Republican response, I want to see if quickly we can get just a word from Garrett Hake, who has been in the chamber for this. Garrett, we have spent a lot of time talking about what we perceived to be the back and forth between the president and what were effectively hecklers on the Republican side. We were sort of chained to the pool camera in terms of what we could see. From inside the room, did you have any further clarity on who was yelling at the president and what that back and forth was like in the few instances in the speech where that happened?
Yeah, Rachel, certainly the most interactive State of the Union I've ever covered. And some of it was clearly intentional on the part of the president when he kind of did the rope-a-dope on protecting Social Security and Medicare. I mean, that was clearly designed to elicit the reaction that it got. And you saw the president kind of give as good as he got in that back and forth. What happened after that was mostly Marjorie Taylor Greene and a handful of other Republicans in the back of the room trying to engage the president further on issues around the border and on fentanyl. You heard Marjorie Taylor Greene call the president a liar. You heard some shouting about China spying on us, secure the border. And another member who I couldn't identify, who's sitting just below me, kind of away from the rest of the most sort of pro-Trump Republicans who sit in the back center of the chamber, who said during the portion of fentanyl deaths that it's your fault, which kind of drew the most gasps and kind of the most negative reaction from fellow Republicans, that was clearly just taking things a little bit too far. So a very, very animated room that I think you could probably argue in all those instances played to President Biden's advantage a little bit. Obviously, the intentional kind of rope-a-dope on Medicare and Social Security, and then Republicans chasing him and trying to respond to him in a way that Kevin McCarthy warned them this morning in their closed-door conference meeting not to do, that the lights and the cameras and the microphones would be on them. And in an effort to look like sort of serious governing partners, that wouldn't do. And there they were.
And Garrett, in the moment, it looked to us like Kevin McCarthy, we were trying to read his body language a little bit, which was hard. And we all had disagreements as to what his body language meant. But some of us felt like he was saying, shush, shush, trying to make eye contact with members who were yelling at the president, telling them to hush. Is that fair? Is that what it seemed like?
That I would have a similar read here, too. I mean, first of all, we know that that's not the way that he wanted to present his conference in terms of getting into a shouting back and forth with the president. He's got a great lengths over the last week to try to present himself and Republicans as sort of worthy partners on something like negotiating the debt ceiling, that they belong in the room with the president. They belong at the White House sitting down at a table like adults. And other Republican members, even Byron Donalds, tweeted today about the adults being back in charge in Washington. That was not the image that Kevin McCarthy wanted, to have his members yelling at the president. But he knows as well as anybody where those cameras are in the chamber. And when you're the speaker, one of them's always on you. And so his ability to communicate that to his conference, at least in any way that would be effective, was pretty limited as well.
One last question for you, Garrett, just about in terms of like sight lines and the kind of thing that you could see when there were Republican members, and you've singled out Marjorie Taylor Greene as one of them. We just played some clips where you could see her repeatedly screaming liar and kind of sneering angrily at the president while she was doing it. When the president was responding to some of those heckling moments, was he looking at the individual Republicans who were screaming and going back at them? That's what it looked like when we had the camera on him at the podium. But is that the direction in which he was looking and directing his own rebuttal?
I got the sense that President Biden was prepared for some of this, right? On the Medicare and Social Security, he clearly was prepared to respond directly. He used that other line that he likes to use about, you know, his old football coach used to say, good luck in your senior year. Yeah. That was clearly directed back at a member. But I think as the heckling went on, the desire or by the president to engage directly kind of went away. I mean, he would sort of pause and look in those general direction. But, you know, and from my perspective, it's a little bit difficult to tell over the clapping and the noise as it happens in real time. But it didn't seem like he was interested in engaging with those interruptions when it got beyond kind of the substantive policy things he wanted to engage with him on.
Garrett Hake, invaluable for us to have you in the room and able to report on some of that. We're now expecting the Republican response to the State of the Union from Sarah Huckabee Sanders. The Republican response tonight from Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders, former press secretary to Donald Trump, with an extended anecdote at the end there about how on a trip with President Trump once, it sort of almost felt like they were in the military. They were not in the military. Other than that, it's kind of an American Carnage speech from Sarah Huckabee Sanders, talking about how President Biden surrendered his presidency to the woke mob, and he has been hijacked by the radical left, and America is having war waged on it by the left, a culture war that that America doesn't want and that the right didn't seek.
You're looking at me. So two things just on a factual basis, which isn't where she's hanging. Donald Trump was known, and it was reported extensively in some of the most harrowing reporting, book reporting, and The Atlantic, I think, broke it, to believe that the men and women who served in the military and died were, quote, suckers and losers. He was especially disgusted by men and women who'd been injured in the service of our country, something that's so sadistic, I don't even like remembering it. So to paint him as some historic, heroic commander in chief is appalling. Politically, personally, the high point was her cancer survival story. And as a young mom and a woman with a lot of ambition, that's a beautiful story. And that she herself, her mother had survived. That was the high point, I think, of the speech. The rest of it was like being kind of high on the 8 p.m. hour on Fox and not recognizing the opportunity she had tonight. She had a massive audience watching, and she could be seen as this person who could get beyond the 29% that's still into that stuff. And she passed up on that political opportunity.
We're going to be joined now, I think. We've still got her. Tell me, control room, if we do. Yes? Great. Joining us now is New York Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Standing by for us. I'm sorry about the delay getting to you, Congresswoman. We had this other thing happen. But thank you very much for being with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Our take from our studio view of the president's speech tonight was that it was unusually interactive. Lawrence O'Donnell used the word combative, described it as the most combative State of the Union speech that he'd ever seen. That was our impression from here. What was your impression in the room, and what did you make of the president's remarks?
Absolutely. I may not have served as many terms or have as much experience as other members, but this is my, fourth or fifth now, and I have never seen a State of the Union that was so disrupted by members of either party. Even under President Donald Trump, we saw nowhere near the level of jeering, interruption, etc., that we saw by some of, I want to say the extreme elements of the Republican Party, but they are now being embraced and uplifted as the center of the Republican Party. It's really shocking. Even the things that the overall Republican Party refused to stand for, paying public school teachers, public health policy, basic education policy, raising the wage for some of our lowest paid workers in the United States. This should be really basic stuff, sky is blue kind of stuff. And the Republican Party, I think, really showed the country who they are tonight, that they have been taken over and that this isn't some right wing. This is the ethos of the modern Republican Party.
We did see the president focus on economic issues and sort of bread and butter issues and working families, middle class families, practical issues throughout almost the duration of his speech. He talked a little bit about Ukraine. He talked a little bit about the Roe versus Wade decision for a little bit. He spent considerable time on police violence and trying to get some sort of police reform. But we really saw him talk about nuts and bolts stuff, kitchen table stuff,
wages, dignity of work, jobs, health care costs, access to health care. I have to imagine that in your district, given its profound diversity, both ethnic and economic diversity, that has to be sort of a I'm guessing that has to be welcome, just in terms of that being the such a large focus of the president's remarks.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I do think that the forcefulness of some of the language that he used, calling out Big Pharma by name, really naming these caps that we have passed on the price of insulin, on out-of-pocket costs, it is powerful. And this is some of the most animating issues that touch the material reality of everyday Americans. I think he did a good job of that while also not letting off corporate greed. As you know, he called out the profit margins of big oil. I mean, I think that it was definitely impactful, and it was surprising, I think, even to some of us, compared to some of his past State of the Unions.
Let me ask you about something I just referenced a moment ago, but let me just ask you in detail about what you thought about the president's lengthy, and I thought quite empathetic, remarks about police violence. He talked about how members of law enforcement are risking their lives when they put on the shield, and that they deserve to come home just like the communities they protect. But community members deserve to come home, too. And there have been too many people killed, and it's not getting better fast enough. And he spent a lot of time engaging with Tyre Nichols' parents, who were there in the gallery watching. And we know so many other family members of people who've been killed by police were there tonight in the room to pay witness. What do you make of the president's remarks and about what he's substantively proposing?
You know, I was surprised by the president's remarks and his focus on reform, focus on justice, and really his focus on centering the families that have been so deeply impacted by police violence and police brutality, and really centering this discussion around reform. If you contrast that with his speech just a year ago, where, you know, this two-dimensional frame of fund or defund, and it was, we're going to fund the police, this is a very different conversation, and one that advocates have been asking for a long time. See what is happening on the ground. See and acknowledge the reality that our communities are experiencing, and that this is a problem that has gone unaddressed for far too long. And so for him to stand up there, to name, you know, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which in and of itself, advocates already believe that it doesn't really go far enough to address the core underlying issues, but still for him to name this legislation, it's a long way from just a year ago, where it was really just about how much more money can we pile into these local departments in order to fix this issue. I also think it's an acknowledgement of the fact that this isn't really connected to funding much at all in terms of how we actually lower these instances of horrific violence in communities. And so I thought it was encouraging. I know myself and some other members were kind of waiting for the shoe to drop. We felt like there was kind of this wind up and that there was going to be a but. And I think we were very relieved and surprised that there was no but, that there was just an acknowledgement that this is actually a problem. And we have not really heard a president do that in such a straightforward way in a long time, if ever, in modern politics.
It's a really astute point, particularly talking about the distance that President Biden himself has come on this issue, perhaps in his own personal understanding, but also in the way he's willing to talk about it. Thank you for that. And thank you for being here. New York Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It's always a real pleasure to have you with us whenever you can be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was a very good point to talk about the distance between what the way Biden addressed this topic on defense on his back foot last year in this same venue compared to the way he talked about it with subtlety, nuance, empathy, understanding, I think, but also a new level of sort of a new depth to his understanding compared to how he's previously.
And it's interesting because I also was kind of waiting for the but. I mean, we have the advantage, and I was sort of leafing through it, waiting for the but as well, because, you know, President Biden, even when he was, you know, Vice President Biden and Senator Biden, has tended to talk about policing as another working class job. And he is working class Joe. And so he has talked with about policing as somebody who empathizes with police as working class workers, right? And empathizes so much with them that the sort of reflex is to say they need more money. Just give them more money. Put more money in, you know, and that's really what was done in the 1990s as well. But I also thought it was refreshing that the focus was on the families, on what parents have to tell their children, on empathy for those who have been harmed or killed, just pure empathy. And he did throw a line in about training, but I thought that the fact that it wasn't a fund the police speech. Yeah. It wasn't a defund the police
but
speech
the,
either.
Congressional Black, I wondered if that was specifically in response to Congressional Black Caucus today saying we want de-escalation training to be mandatory for police in every department in the country, which is a very specific thing. It's not like we just want more training money for cops. It was we want this
specific
helpful
thing.
And I wondered if it might have been a reference to that in the way that he brought that up.
I think also, I mean, you talk about the last State of the Union where it was, of course, we want to fund the police, because he was in the middle of a kind of political battle with the right that was saying Democrats want to defund the police. Yes. They want to end policing as we know it. The right wing has not come out in the aftermath of the Tyre Nichols, that horrifying video that I think really shook a lot of people to their core, and done anything but stay silent. And so there is political space for him to actually address this problem in a comprehensive way without feeling like he needs to make some kind of acknowledgement to the right to prove that Democrats are serious about fighting crime.
I also just think, when you think about that section of the Biden speech and Biden's general approach and the response that we saw from Sarah Huckabee Sanders and the images that are now floating around Getty of Marjorie Taylor Greene in what some think looks like Cruella DeVille cosplay, yelling at the president. Like, the point of politics in a liberal democracy is to try to persuade people. If persuasion is not possible, then the whole enterprise falls apart. And sometimes it's very easy to think that persuasion isn't possible because we're polarized. But I tend to think, as a public communicator myself, persuasion is possible, and there's ways to talk to people that are more or less persuasive. And I just am so struck by the inability of people on the American right this day and age to speak in ways that just sound
normal,
open and normal to people, and inviting of persuasion. And the Sarah Huckabee Sanders, that register, the woke mob, she surrendered to the woke mob, this whole thing, that was the campaign they run in the midterms. Like, that were the ads, the mailers showing up in Michigan where they got their butts handed to them.
The communists are coming for your babies.
They have tried all this. And look, there are universes in which that kind of high-pitched rhetoric, sometimes it can be persuasive and activating. It worked on crime in New York. So it's not like that never works. It just strikes me as such a strange asymmetry in American life that one side really does seem trapped in this strange echo chamber where you just say CRT without explaining what it is. You just all these jargon and words and Latinx you banned from state government. It's like, what are you talking about? I understand I'm not the median voter and I'm not the audience for it, but it is strange how hermetically sealed the rhetorical universe of the American right continues to be this many years into the MAGA experiment.
A lot of people watching that may be remembering her as press secretary, maybe remembering because the unusual name that she's the daughter of a former governor, are going to have no idea what she was talking about using acronyms without explaining them, talking about how Democrats don't believe there are women. This idea that there's even the idea that a woke mob is a thing that you just referenced without sort of explaining what you mean by that. It only exists in a specific part of a polity that, again, it's not in sort of.
But there is an overarching strategic reason for this. And that is the two senators per state formula, which allows the Republicans, just by making these non-persuasive arguments, to still win control of the Senate in certain circumstances, and the Electoral College. There is not a Republican theory for how a Republican candidate can get the most votes for president in America. The only way to do that is through persuasion, which they've given up on. The game is the Electoral College. They are a party that has abandoned persuasion, which is where they used to live, you know, to try to get into the middle there. They've abandoned it on the belief that the strategy is suppress Democratic votes as much as possible, win enough senators in the states that we can control so that we get a majority, and win the presidency through the Electoral College without ever changing a mind in our favor, but simply turning out the votes we need in the Electoral College buckets where we need them and in the states where we need them to control the Senate. It is not a persuasion party.
Let's bring into the conversation now Democratic U.S. Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut. Senator Murphy, thank you so much for joining us. We know this is a big, long night already for you. Thank you so much, sir.
Yeah, sure. Good to be with you.
So we've been talking tonight about a remarkable moment, a sort of a crescendo that happened right in the middle of the president's speech, in which Republicans seem to be sort of heckling, taunting, booing, screaming at him. And in Garrett Hake's words, our reporter who was there in the room where you were, he described it as the president essentially responding with a rope-a-dope in which he ended up engaging, doing a kind of call and response with his would-be hecklers and getting them in the end to endorse unanimously the idea of not cutting Social Security or Medicare, sort of committing to it on the stage. It seemed like incredible theater from where we sat. I have to ask you if you saw it the same way and what it was like from your vantage point.
Well, that is a wonderfully optimistic take on what happened this evening. The idea that we suddenly forced a conversion of Republicans on the question of protecting Social Security and Medicare. I don't think that's actually what occurred in that chamber, because I know I've watched Republicans for a decade trip over themselves to propose new ways to cut Social Security and Medicare. Just last Congress, 160 members of the House proposed raising the retirement age for Social Security to 70. Rick Scott, one of the most influential Republicans in the Senate, who led the Senate Campaign Committee, wants to sunset Social Security and Medicare after 5 years. These guys want to do only a handful of things in life, and one of them is cut entitlements. But they know it's really politically unpopular. So when the lights are on, they don't want to get caught red-handed. And when the president called them out directly tonight, their instinct was to stand up and protest. But thou doth protest a bit too much. They've been after Social Security and Medicare for a long time. There is no doubt that it's going to be on the table as part of their price to raise the debt ceiling. And I thought the president was smart to, at the very least, if he wasn't going to get some agreement in the room, to make clear to the American public where they stand.
What did you make of the overall thrust of the president's speech focusing on infrastructure, focusing on drug prices, focusing on the things that have been passed and the accomplishments that he's had thus far around very basic human economic concerns, the number of jobs, wages going up, inflation coming down, manufacturing jobs being reestablished, there being lots of manufacturing jobs now in the pipeline, which will be six-figure salaries for people who don't have to have four-year degrees in order to get those kinds of jobs. I mean, the president, my colleague Chris Hayes here, was talking about the fact that a lot of stuff that's real, real hot button, very important political stuff got squished down so that those things could really be the great bulk of what the president talked about tonight. What did you make of that?
So I thought the whole speech was great, but I thought that first 20 minutes to a half an hour was the best the president has ever been. Now, he's always good sort of making this metaphysical connection with the American public. But listen, I think he knows what's going to happen for the next 2 years. I think he knows that there's not a great chance that we're going to get the kind of big legislative achievement that we got in the last 2 years. So he's speaking directly to the American people, right? He's talking about these forgotten Americans. He's talking to people about how their communities, their cities feel sort of weaker than ever before. And he's really speaking to the dignity that people feel that they have lost. And I just thought it was brilliant the way that he was speaking, you know, directly into the middle of the country, not just sort of middle income America, but literally middle America, right, talking to the red states. And it just stood in contrast to Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who I got to listen to as I was waiting to come on the air. You know, what's this woke mob agenda she's talking about? It's infrastructure. It's lowering the cost of insulin. It just doesn't make sense to Americans that that's an extreme agenda. So you put her sort of dystopian hellscape vision of America next to the first half an hour of that speech, which just seems so rational and so thoughtful and so apolitical, that I think it's a wonderful advertisement for the kind of leadership that President Biden is bringing.
Senator Murphy, it's Lawrence O'Donnell. I wanted to ask you about a section of the speech that we haven't seen before in a Democratic State of the Union, and that is going into this kind of microeconomic kitchen table detail about credit card interest rates and resort fees being thrown onto your hotel room when you go to some place with your kids, airlines charging you extra money just to try to sit with your kids together on a plane. This was going as micro as I've seen a Democratic president go. How do you think that's playing in Connecticut?
Listen, I think to the point you were making earlier, you know, the Republicans talk in these sort of overtly, overly politicized terms, CRT, woke mobs. You know, the president is using terminology that everybody understands, right? You know, Ticketmaster sucks. And it just speaks to people. But it's micro politics, but it speaks to a broader theme, right? Which is folks just don't feel like they have control any longer. Their lives have become more complicated and more loaded up with hassle than ever before. And they want the government to just help simplify their lives a little bit, right? They protect my kids when they go online. Make sure I don't get gouged when I'm buying a plane ticket to go see my ailing grandmother. And so, yeah, he's talking about really sort of specific issues that people face, but he's speaking to this broad imbalance that people feel between the power that these companies and corporations have and the power that they feel they should have.
Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, sir, it's really great to have you with us tonight. I know, as I said, it's been a long night already. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. It's been a weird night. The State of the Union by President Biden was not your typical State of the Union. It did not go the way any of us expected it to go, myself especially included in that. I would also say that the Republican response, the dystopian hellscape, as Senator Murphy put it, also maybe not what we were all expecting, but it just means there's so much more to talk about. We'll be right back right after this. Stay with us.
I stand here tonight after we've created, with the help of many people in this room, 12 million new jobs, more jobs created in 2 years than any president's created in 4 years because of you all, because of the American people. In the last 2 years, my administration has cut the deficit by more than $1.7 trillion. The largest deficit reduction in American history. Under the previous administration, the American deficit went up 4 years in a row. Because those record deficits, no president added more to the national debt in any 4 years than my predecessor. Nearly 25% of the entire national debt that took over 200 years to accumulate was added by just one administration alone, the last one. They're the facts. Check it out. Check it out.
They're the facts. Check it out. Check it out. And then there was a lot more check it out thereafter. Joining us now is our dear friend Stephanie Ruhle. Steph, I wanted to play that for you because I felt like, I love that this was the start of the fighting part of the speech, which we've all been talking about as a kinetic moment. But I wondered what you thought of it actually on the substance.
Well, because the economy is what is so frustrating to this administration, because we have made huge economic strides, especially if you consider where we came from in the depths of COVID. And we all know this. The president really isn't getting credit for it. But Joy and I talked about this earlier. Tell me any time in history where people said, I feel great about my financial situation. I love how things are. People never feel good. But the president is getting frustrated. And he's trying to push this point in large part because Republicans are offering absolutely nothing. They haven't articulated what they want to do about the debt ceiling. And as far as them dumping on Biden and his economy, what are they offering? Nothing.
Here's what's so wild, too, about that clip. The reason, I mean, obviously it's true, right? Like the fact that Republicans have, like, the numbers are the numbers. But also, this was arguably one of the best things that Donald Trump and Steve Mnuchin and Nancy Pelosi did, which was pass the CARES Act, which was trillions of dollars when the entire economy shut down. And part of the reason that we aren't in the midst of a great recession 2.0, right, where we take forever to get back to full employment, was because Donald Trump, who did not care one whit about the deficit, was happy to sign as many checks to every individual American he could in an election year, went along with Nancy Pelosi and Steve Mnuchin, who worked that deal out, to, like,
run up the money machine. And the hilarious thing is that and the vaccines are probably the two best things that Donald Trump did when he ran for president, and he is going to run away from both of them the next time that he
runs. But even the American Rescue Plan, which Republicans didn't support, when it actually came to pass, and the Restaurant Act, which was part of it, those restaurants got all that money. You saw Republicans state by state standing there for photo opportunities when you saw their favorite mom and pop diners reopen, and they were taking credit for it. And you heard the president say tonight when he was talking about infrastructure, he said, "I'll see you at those groundbreakings."
That's right,
clearly throwing amazing shade because you know that's going to happen.
Yeah. And the unforced errors parts of it, I think, are pretty funny, because the reason that Biden was able to attack Republicans for wanting to sunset Social Security is because Rick Scott, who again was in charge of the Senate reelection, he was the guy in charge of the Senate reelect, put on paper, "This is our plan for America. We're going to sunset these programs," including, he said he was going to do it. And the other pieces, they did raise the debt ceiling multiple times, which Biden points out in his speech.
And he's like, they go crazy when he points it out.
They go crazy and they started getting mad. It's like, yes, you did. Yes.
You know, I wonder, Lawrence, what you think Mitch McConnell is thinking as he watches, right, Marjorie Taylor Greene in her, like, sort of Santa of February outfit, heckling the President of the United States.
She made
Kevin McCarthy.
Calling George Santos a liar. You don't know who she was calling a liar.
Right. Very good point, Stephanie. Always give her the benefit of the doubt.
You were not
And he's, as our fellow, our colleagues point out very astutely, you know, he's talking about these shovel-ready projects that are going to occur in, you know, red states that did not vote for him. He harkens back to the bridge that he and Mitch McConnell were in front of in early January as Kevin McCarthy is in the fight of his life to hold the speaker's gavel. There's this bipartisan event featuring the Republican minority leader in the Senate and the President of the United States, a Democrat, almost live trolling Kevin McCarthy as he tries to win over his fractious caucus. And here is Mitch McConnell, who is shouted out by the president at the start of all of this, right? And with whom you sense there is a camaraderie, a kinship, weirdly, between these two long former senator and this long-serving senator. And then the absolute chaos in the House. Kevin McCarthy unable to in any way control the situation, mouthing sort of soft, you know, muzzle thyself. But what must he think in this moment as he watches the absolute degradation of the grand old party?
It was a very good night for Mitch McConnell. He needs the Republican House to be seen as deranged and out of control, because he, in the end, in his version of the debt ceiling increase, hopes to marshal the money people of the Republican Party to talk to Kevin McCarthy. They already are. But to move in a way that will crush the screaming hordes in the back of that room, Marjorie Taylor Greene. She's who has to be crushed. And so Mitch McConnell is very happy with the way this went tonight, that they exhibited the madness that they exhibited there. He's the adult in that party. He remains the adult in that party. He's going to have to kind of not get caught doing what he does, you know, by the Marjorie Taylor Greene section of the party. She's made it easier by being crazier tonight for him to work the way he wants to work. But he knows that in the end, the debt ceiling will be increased if Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden can figure out the way to do it, and do it getting around and using and manipulating Kevin McCarthy. So it was a good night for Mitch.
And a sad night for Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah, because he demonstrated his powerlessness on the speaker's chair tonight, because the thing he was trying to do from the speaker's chair is stop them from yelling at the president.
Yeah.
And and we're going to have the loop. It'll be set up on video somewhere of all the times he was telling them to shush, shush, shush. Yeah. There's this shot. There's this weird shot of him. He's doing this thing with his mouth where he's trying to communicate with 200 people sitting in front of him to be quiet by pursing his lips in this way that he tried to do. And there's about five of those that's going to be on a loop. And he failed.
Yeah.
He
that's completely the problem
failed.
With
that.
Trying
thing,
to do it is not the problem. Trying to do it and failing.
Not to speak, and he failed.
You know who's good at that? Because Nancy Pelosi gives you that grandma look, that look that you get when you know you're in trouble and you're in the store and you're acting up. She gives you that look. and you shut up.
But she doesn't have crazies. Her look was never tested against crazies. These people in the back of the room are crazy. Yeah,
that is like a mother whose children are sitting on the other side of the aisle in mass, and she's giving them the...
And they're giving her the, can't hear you, don't know what you're saying,
and just going on and on. Fox News's response, what was their immediate push notification? All they had was, four Supreme Court justices did not show for Biden's State of the Union. I mean, that's astounding. If you think Fox News primetime, like coming out the gates with everything to refute, that was it?
The same Supreme Court justices that don't ever go to the State of the Union didn't go tonight.
Ginsburg wasn't even there.
News at 11. All right, much more of our special coverage of the State of the Union ahead. Stay with us.
And folks, we're just getting started. We're just getting started. And I mean it sincerely. I want to thank my Republican friends who voted for the law and my Republican friends who voted against it as well. But I still get asked to fund the projects in those districts as well. But don't worry. I promised I'd be a president for all Americans. We'll fund these projects. And I'll see you at the groundbreaking. Look. Join us tonight are the parents of Tyree Nichols. Welcome. We had to bury Tyree last week. As many of you personally know, there's no words to describe the heartache or grief of losing a child. But imagine. Imagine if you lost that child at the hands of the law. Imagine having to worry whether your son or daughter came home from walking down the street, or playing in the park, or just driving a car. Most of us in here have never had to have the talk that brown and black parents have had to have with their children. Bo, Hunter, Ashley, my children, I never had to have a talk with them. I never had to tell them if a police officer pulls you over, turn your interior lights on right away. Don't reach for your license. Keep your hands on the steering wheel. Imagine having to worry like that every single time your kid got in a car. Here's what Tyree's mother shared with me when I spoke to her. When I ask her how she finds the courage to carry on and speak out. With the faith of God, she said her son was, quote, a beautiful soul, and something good will come of this.
Joining us now is Nevada Congressman Stephen Horsford. He is chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, who invited Tyree Nichols' parents as guests tonight, as well as siblings and parents, family members of a number of other people who have been killed in police violence. Congressman Horsford, I really appreciate you taking time to be with us tonight. Thank you, sir.
It's my honor. Thank you for having me.
We were talking here at MSNBC earlier tonight in the immediate aftermath of the president's speech about that moment in the speech that then went on at length. And the president talked about this issue not as a sort of dance card punch, as a thing to get through on a list of policy, on a list of long policies. He spent a long time, and certainly the most emotional time of the speech, in an extended discussion about the sort of grand moral empathy required of us as Americans to try to fix this problem. It was a surprising, I think, turn in the speech. I think it was very effective. I wonder what you thought in the room tonight.
I cannot thank President Biden and Vice President Harris enough for speaking to the hearts of the American people today, of taking the plea of the mother of Tyree Nichols and so many other families who have lost a loved one or had a loved one traumatized because of their interaction with law enforcement. And he was very clear that this is not a Republican problem or a Democratic problem. This is a public safety issue. This is not something that only some of us have to fix. This is something that all of us have to work together to address. And I commend him, and I think it's going to really help us as we move forward in passing substantive public safety and accountability reforms in Congress.
Congressman, this is Joy Reid. I wonder, when having the families there, having Tyre Nichols' mom and dad, also George Floyd's brother, Philonis, was also there, what kind of conversations are CBC members having with the families about how realistic the timeline is for actually passing police reform, given the makeup of the House of Representatives, given the raucousness of the right wing caucus that controls that body? Are you all having conversations with them about the likelihood that this will not be immediate and that it will be very difficult to pass this kind of legislation this year?
Well, you're right, Joy. Look, we're going to keep working to pass George Floyd Justice and Policing for as long as it takes. But that doesn't mean that we cannot get meaningful reforms enacted now around public safety and accountability that the families are calling for. Earlier today, we did do a roundtable discussion with more than 15 families. They were guests of members of the Congressional Black Caucus who had, in one way or another, have been affected by police brutality in this country. And every one of them told us, do what you can, work with who you can, tell us who we need to talk to. Even in the course of leaving the State of the Union, Mrs. Wells, Tyre's mother, was stopped by a number of my colleagues, including Republicans. And she told them, don't just pray for me, I need you to act. And the Congressional Black Caucus is leading this effort. We've already reached out to the civil rights organizations, to faith-based leaders, to executives in corporate America. It's going to take all of us, as I said, because this is not a black or brown or white issue. This is a public safety and accountability issue. And all of us can do something. As the president said today, we can do big things. We did it on gun safety. We did it on infrastructure. We did it on bringing American jobs back in manufacturing. Clearly, we can do it to keep our community safe from violence, particularly police-related violence.
Congressman, I think it's fair to say that the president's remarks tonight live in their own sort of status here. But part of the reason that we are having this discussion tonight about this part of the president's speech, and part of the reason that this is going to be remembered as part of the State of the Union and this will have ongoing policy resonance, is because the organizing work that you and the Congressional Black Caucus did to get those family members there, you changed the conversation around this entire speech and this address with that organizing effort. I have a feeling you knew that might be the impact if this worked successfully. It was a remarkable act of politics in its own right.
It wasn't so much about politics. Yes, it took some strategic thinking and execution, but I'll tell you this. The president called. I talked to him earlier last week. The vice president called. They immediately took us up on our request to have a meeting to discuss how the president could use this moment of the State of the Union to really center this issue of public safety and accountability in a way that has never been done before. And I commend him for that. But make no mistake, this is not for politics, because there are lives on the line. And every day, black people and brown people fear for their children when they leave our homes, whether that's going to a park or being stopped in a traffic stop. But at no point should someone lose their life as a result. And so we're asking the same thing that everyone else is asking, for our communities to be safe. And we can do this. We can do it by supporting law enforcement, but calling for the end of bad policing, which should not exist anywhere in America. And I'm asking the American people to work with us and to call out to those members on the other side of the aisle to work with us as well.
Nevada Congressman Stephen Horsford, chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. Sir, thank you for helping us understand tonight. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, we've got much more to come here tonight. Just stay with us.
Congress must restore the right that was taken away in Roe v. Wade and protect Roe v. Wade. Give every woman a constitutional right. Make no mistake about it. If Congress passes a national ban, I will veto it. So tonight, let's all agree, and we apparently are, let's stand up for seniors. Stand up and show them. We'll not cut Social Security. We will not cut Medicare. Those benefits belong to the American people. They earned it. And if anyone tries to cut Social Security, which apparently no one's going to do, and if anyone tries to cut Medicare, I'll stop them. I'll veto it. And look, I'm not going to allow them to take away, be taken away, not today, not tomorrow, not ever. But apparently it's not going to be a problem.
Apparently, it's not going to be a problem.
Even Kevin McCarthy is smirking it. Even Kevin
He's like, I can't believe you just got us to do all this. Let's bring into the conversation now Simone Sanders Townsend and Jen Psaki, both veterans of the Biden administration. Simone and Jen, I want to ask you both if you guys have any intel, if you've heard anything from the Biden side, from the White House side, in terms of how they feel about the speech tonight and how this raucous State of the Union is going over with them.
Well, I'll say I have heard that, of course, they think the president did great. But I did ask some of our former colleagues, Jen and I's former colleagues, about the back and forth between the president and hecklers. And they were very clear to note that it is not a back and forth. He is the president. And that it was a clear contrast that was laid out tonight. And I thought that that was stark. So and I frankly think that the president took on the hecklers and walked away not looking small, which is very hard to do.
Yeah.
Jen,
so, Rachel,
hearing?
I mean, what's happening in the White House right now is, one, there's food containers everywhere. There's chicken fingers. There's French fries. People are so over-caffeinated. They're half shaking, half just trying to hurl themselves across the finish line. And I think there's an elation. That is what I've heard from people in the White House and our former colleagues. Because anytime you pour all your words and blood, sweat, and tears and all the things into speeches like this, you still hold your breath while it's being delivered. It's kind of like a show parent moment, right, where you're watching it happen and you're thinking, you know, there's going to be hecklers. How's he going to respond? Is he going to respond in the right way? And there's just relief and elation and real pride, because this is a really a many months long process.
And Simone, what you were saying about how it wasn't a back and forth from their perspective, it was the president kind of handling this issue. Should we read into that this whole thing where he effectively baited them into screaming at him about Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare, and then got them to stand up unanimously and endorse that there would be no cuts, that was kind of his plan, that this was what he
I think that what happened is that the president and the president's team rightfully anticipated that Republicans would say he's not telling the truth about Social Security and Medicare, of course we're not going to do that, and then got them to stand up and clap. Now I do think that you had the good senator from Connecticut on just a while ago that said that's what their body language said, but their words and their actions have spoke differently. And so for me, it was striking that not hear anything about Medicaid or the affordable or any assurances about the Affordable Care Act, when the Medicaid is something that right now is affecting folks all across the country, because there had been a moratorium on kicking folks off. And because of the pandemic is now over, I'm going to use quotes, pandemic's not actually over, but that moratorium is ending. And there are lots of folks across the country who now may be without health care.
That's right. Simone Sanders Townsend, Jen Psaki, both veterans of the Biden White House. Great to have you both with us tonight. All right. It has been a remarkable night, from all the surprises in the State of the Union to all the surprises in the State of the Union. But our coverage of the State of the Union continues in just a minute with the great Stephanie Ruhle and Ali Velshi. Don't go anywhere.